Welcome to TAN Conversations, a series that brings together serious Catholic thinkers to discuss fascinating, challenging, and timeless topics. Reinforce your faith with the saints, scripture, the spiritual life, and so much more. Another episode of TAN Conversations begins now.
The Devil and Karl Marx, new book by Dr. Paul Kangor, published by TAN Books. Today I'm joined with Dr. Kangor to discuss this new book. Dr. Kangor is a best-selling author, professor at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. It's a wonderful college. Paul, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. Yeah. Great to be on.
And in prepping for this show, I wrote down so many questions. Do you mind if we just dive right in?
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah. We don't have to hit them all. We could do a part two if you want to. We'll hit what we can. I think we have about 25 minutes.
25 minutes. We've got the stopwatch. So we'll get you out of here on time.
All right.
all right. Just the first one. It's The Devil and Karl Marx. It's a provocative title, some would say. So what made you choose that title?
Well, part of it, Zach, is that it's a continuation with the theme that I've done before. So my first major book was called God and Ronald Reagan. That came out in 2004. And then I did a book called God and George W. Bush, who was a sitting president at the time. I even did God and Hillary Clinton. And I was asked by the publisher, which was Judith Regan's imprint at HarperCollins. God and Ronald Reagan was a bestseller. I think God and George W. Bush made the bestseller list too. By the way, God and Hillary Clinton completely tanked. It was caught between, as we said inside with the publisher, it was caught between conservatives who didn't believe she believed in God and liberals who didn't care that she believed in God. And the book was translated into one language, Vietnamese, of all things. And on the binder, there's a little red star on the thing to get translated into Vietnam. Whereas God and Ronald Reagan translated into Polish and all the languages behind the Iron Curtain. But they asked me to do what they called more God and books after that, basically spiritual biography. And I said, no, I turned down a couple. And I even had somebody, I guess I could say this, why not, in 2017 asked me to do God and Donald Trump. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. We even asked him about it. We even asked Trump about it. If I had been given access, I might have. I don't know. But so this is kind of that theme. And you're not going to write God and Karl Marx because Marx didn't believe in God. And the main reason, the Devil and Karl Marx, that's a play on titles like The Devil and Daniel Webster and so forth. But Marx literally wrote about the devil. He wrote some really chilling poetry and even plays about the devil, about the dark side. And this, you know, Zach, this is known by people who go back quite a ways. I've gotten emails in the last few days. People usually, you know, like 60s, 70s, 80s, people who are up there saying, oh, yeah, I remember reading about this in Paul Johnson's book, right? I remember reading about this in Pastor Richard Wurmbrand's book. I remember reading about this in the, you know, the best-selling biography of Marx by Richard Payne in 1968, where he had a chapter called The Demons, where Payne really, he was a literature professor, and he's the guy that found a lot of this stuff, and not a conservative, I think probably a man of the left. But so with all of that out there, that's it. I mean, Marx wrote about the devil, and this book really probably ought to be called Devil and Communism, because it has a few chapters on Marx, over 100 pages on Marx, but it goes into communism generally, the church, the Catholic Church, describing communism as a satanic scourge, as a product of the sons of darkness. The church used that language. And I even talk about figures ranging from Saul Alinsky to Mikhail Bakunin, Walter Benjamin, Kate Millett, all people that some have said dabbled in the occult and even worse than that. So long answer to your question, but there you go.
And so in doing research, because this is a thick book, I mean, this is close to 500, close to 500 pages.
Yeah, 460 pages, I think. It's about 140,000 words. My book, God and Ronald Reagan, was 110,000 words. And so I did a book called The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism. That was like 140,000 words, almost identical to this. It's a long book.
It looks like it's very well documented, very well researched. So in all the research that you were putting into that book, what was one thing that was very surprising that maybe you went into the book thinking, like when I was reading about Bella Dodd, I mean, I was basically grew up with understanding like, okay, she testified in front of Congress, made those claims. But later on in your book, I think it was like chapter 10 or 11, you were talking about, no, actually she was, I think she told Von Hildebrand, right. About that. So like there's a lot of interesting things that I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. But you doing the research, what was like one thing that just you were surprised when you actually did the research to learn?
Well, it's hard to pick one thing, but I'd say with Bella Dodd's claims, she claimed to have placed, quote, over 1,000 communist men, unquote, in Catholic seminaries. And she did that as a Communist Party member and organizer. And, you know, Zach, that's something that she was capable of doing because for the party, the Communist Party, she organized teachers, and especially in the state of New York. And she literally organized or attempted to organize the placing of thousands of Communist Party members into the teachers union. So the idea to her that they could find 1,000 communist men and place them among, you know, 30,000, 40,000 priests and seminarians probably seemed like a cinch. It wouldn't have seemed that difficult to her. And I walk through that in the book because there's a lot of junk on the internet about Bella Dodd's claims, and including from fellow Catholics, right? That say Bella Dodd did this, right? She said in her blank speech, you know, Fordham, Utica, whatever, that she did this. And then I'd go and I'd check online and I'd be looking and I'd hear the audio of the speech. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, here it is. Finally, here's where she talks about placing the 1,000 communist men. And then the audio stops. And then somebody, you know, overlays text about her. And they're like, where is it? Where did she say this? Bella said to Congress. And, no, she didn't say it to Congress. She didn't say it to Congress. So I go through where she said it, where she might have said it, where we believe she might have said it. And the tricky thing about Bella Dodd is that so much of what she said has never been declassified. And at the time of her death, I quote this from the Congressional Record, one of the congressmen who said, yeah, she told us, you know, hundreds of pages of material that we had to redact, that we had to keep confidential. And I made a FOIA request, Zach, for her Freedom of Information Act request for her FBI file. And it still hasn't been released. So I finished this book in that chapter, regrettably, without getting her freedom, without getting her FBI file. When I did a book on Obama's mentor, Frank Marshall Davis, it's called The Communist, I had a 600-page FBI file. We have the FBI files of Whitaker Chambers, Alger Hiss, the Rosenbergs. I go on and on and on. Howard Zinn. But we still, Bella Dodd still has not been released. And she died, over 50 years ago. So I really wish we had that. I'd like to see what's in it. And at the very least, it looks like she and the party did at least attempt to try to place, quote unquote, over 1,000 communist men in Catholic seminaries. The degree to which they succeeded, that's an open question, but at least they wanted to. That's clear. Well, there was an intent.
Yeah. And in that, I was towards the back half of the book, it was actually page 273. It discusses the Communist Party for an axiom for organizational strategy. So like in the book, it was saying 1% Communist Party members plus 9% Communist Party sympathizers with well-rehearsed plans of action can effectively control the remaining 90%. And I was just curious if you can comment on that, because in my mind, I'm like, these guys, it seems like they have successfully infiltrated aspects of not only the Catholic Church, but it looked like just Christianity in general, as along with other religions, but how do they do that? So that 1% plus 9% can control the 90%. Can you just comment or just go into that a little bit further? Because that seems like a strong strategy.
Yeah, it's very shrewd of you to pick up on that. I was thinking this morning that an op-ed that I should write would be one that pulls out from the book. I give, I think, four different examples of that. Bella Dodd, Manning Johnson, the next communist testifying before Congress. Ben Gitlow ran for president of the United States, vice president of the United States on the Communist Party, USA. Ex-communist testifying before Congress. Louis Boudens, who converted to Catholicism, ex-communist. I think there's four different spots in the book where I quote these guys, and I've known this for years because I wrote a book called Dupes, almost 10 years ago, which focused on this as well. These guys, all these communist ringleaders, organizers, always marveled at their ability of a handful of them to take a progressive organization, take control of it, and completely control and manipulate the direction of it and push it in a pro-Soviet or pro-communist direction. And a lot of times, I've seen this so many times in my life with so many different examples. I saw it again last week with a colleague of mine. I probably shouldn't go into detail on it. But they'll see what certain leaders of an organization are doing to an organization, Zach. You know what their response is? Ah, forget it. I'm out of here. Right. And that's exactly what the people who are hijacking the organization are hoping to do. And I told this colleague of mine, I said, you know, don't walk away from the organization. Right. Stay in and try to save it. Why would you let five or six people who have made their way, wormed their way into this organization, take it over? Do you love, you know, organization X or not? Do you love Presbyterian Church USA or not? Do you love CPAC or not, right? Do you love the United Methodist Church or not? If you do, then don't let Harry Ward and his Methodist Federation for Social Action come in and hijack the United Methodist Church. Fight them, right? But people get frustrated. They don't like the tension. They don't like the acrimony. And the communists realize, wow, just a handful of us operating very shrewdly, very wisely, and by the way, very frequently lying, right, deceiving, wolves in sheep's clothing, are really able to shape and redirect an entire organization's right. mission.
So there was another part, and so this was such an interesting chapter because it was discussing the Catholic Church. It was discussing just the infiltration in religion in general, which I found surprising because I thought that their target was specifically the Catholic Church, but it sounded like that was a target, but in general, they wanted to penetrate all of the religions. So I found that surprising, but the one thing it was page 287. And it said Moscow ordered infiltration of the Catholic Church and Dominicans. And I was just curious why specifically the Dominicans were targeted and why not another religious order? Like what was it about the Dominicans that was maybe a threat to them?
Right.
I'm not sure.
I was surprised by that too, because the Dominicans are so solid today. And I would have thought it would have been another organization, like
right.
the Jesuits, right? Which they certainly did through liberation theology in the 1960s and 1970s. But I think that claim against the Dominicans, I think that was in the 1930s in that case. Yeah, I was surprised by that too. That one doesn't really make sense to me. I quoted it, and I wonder if that person really knew what he was talking about. Although there have been a case of some radical Dominicans over the years, right? And so you might know of somebody out there who's kind of a ripe target, as the communists used to say, right? Who's a pliable sucker. They used to use that word sucker a lot. And so that's who they thus targeted. Even the Franciscans from time to time. But by and large, they realized that the Catholic Church was a really formidable foe. And the communists believed that they would have much better success with the mainline denomination. So they really went after the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, and Presbyterian Church USA. And those are really the three that went left the quickest, which is why somebody could tell you who is formerly a member of Presbyterian Church USA. I was formerly an evangelical. So many of the people in the mainline denominations who are more orthodox have gone out and created non-denominational, independent evangelical churches. So the success or the attempt to push these churches to the left, and it doesn't have to be all the way to the Marxist left, but just to generally move them to the left, that had the effect of a lot of people in those churches over the years saying, I've had it. I'm out of here. You can have your Presbyterian church. I'm going to go join whatever. And I know others who've stayed in to fight those battles, but that's who they target.
And going back to chapter 3, so I was really interested in Marx's upbringing. And so I was surprised. So it sounds like the town that he grew up in was like 90% Catholic. His parents were, I think, Jewish, and then they converted to Lutheranism, right?
That's right.
And then it sounded like Karl Marx did. So he had a religious upbringing, but then I think you were saying that his dad would like quote Voltaire to him. So he seemed like a little wacky, his father.
Right.
But then he went to college, and it seemed like then the wheels fell off the wagon. And he became atheist somewhere. And I'm just trying to, do you know what was like what caused that? Or like, what was the trigger point? Like, was there something very dramatic in his life that all of a sudden he's like, boom, I'm now atheist. I'm going to, write this manifesto. And I know he was a poet, and it sounded like some of that was leaking into his poetry early on. But like, was there like a specific event or like a trigger, or do you think it was a combination of like just his parents bringing him up within a somewhat religious house, but not so much?
I'd blame some of it on liberal Christianity, kind of like Stalin going off to a seminary that was not Orthodox, but very liberal, very a lot of belief in evolution, very progressive, and ended up, by the time he, a few years in a seminary, he no longer believed in God. Of all things, with Marx, the father converted to not Catholicism, which was the vast majority of the people in Trier, the town that they were born in. By the way, Trier, the Gothic cathedral there goes back to the 300s. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, Saint Ambrose, who would bring Augustine into the church, was a bishop there. Saint Helena, no less than Saint Helena, built that cathedral, the mother of Constantine, and brought back from the Holy Land the original holy robe or holy coat that Jesus wore to the crucifixion that the Roman soldiers cast lots for, or at least she believed that's what it was. And so that's still there to this day. Most of the Jews who converted, including Heinrich Marx, Marx's father's brothers, this would have been Marx's uncle, the uncle converted to Catholicism. Most of them did. But Marx's father converted to Lutheranism, which he believed, like Martin Luther. And by the way, I quote in here Marx praising Martin Luther. They liked how Luther allowed them to define their own interpretations, their own views, and their own interpretation and belief in the Bible and Scripture apart from the authority of the church. And for Marx, that break from the church as an authority was just gigantic, right? In the dialectical march of history, a key thing for Marx was to be able to say that the church doesn't have the authority to interpret Scripture, or it rejects the magisterial authority of the church, in effect. So Marx's father was a pretty liberal Lutheran, and who kind of cast around and was free with his beliefs, passed that along to Karl. And then by the time Karl was in college at the University of Bonn, he had a professor named Dr. Bruno Bauer. Oh, here's another classic example. A liberal atheist at a German university teaching courses on systematic theology, right? Catholic parents listening right now, how many of you are going to say, oh, Johnny's okay at that liberal college? He's taking a course on theology. Who do you think's teaching it? C.S. Lewis? I mean, come on, right? I had one parent say, I said, how's that course going? Well, not very well. The professor's an atheist. So, well, yeah, of course. You think they're going to let Bishop Robert Barron teach the course? I mean, come on. So he connected with this atheist professor, Dr. Bruno Bauer. And by 1841, Marx would have been 23 years old. Young Marx is helping his professor found a journal called the Archives of Atheism. So it didn't take long once he got into college for him to make a complete and total break from his Christian religious faith.
Wow, that's amazing. And we just to let you know, a time check, we got 5 minutes, Paul. And I'm so let me go.
Well, we could wrap up with maybe one more question, and maybe we can do a part two in this series, maybe next week or the week after, maybe a regular series.
That would be awesome. Okay, the one kind of question is that it seems that many young people are attracted to socialism, communism, Marxism. And why do you think that is? And also, can you also help define, really, maybe it's for me, I'm sure the audience already knows the definitions between socialism, communism, and then even like Marxist communism versus maybe like atheistic communism. Like there's distinctions, it seems, between those. So like question 1A is, why do you think younger people are attracted to this? And question...
Well, it's all related. Yeah, I can tell you because they're attracted to it because they don't know this stuff, what they've learned. And in fact, you can see this, Zach, in different surveys. They'll say, I approve of communism, right? I prefer socialism over capitalism. And then some of the surveys, there haven't been many that have done this, but a few have, will say, okay, how do you define communism? How do you define socialism? And they don't say, well, like it says in the Communist Manifesto, abolition of all private property. Abolition of the family. I support those things, right? Abolition of all religion. No, they say, well, it's about being kind to one another. It's about sharing. It's about helping your fellow man. It's about redistributing money from the filthy rich to the poor, right? They don't understand it. And if they read books like this and they knew things like this, they'd reject it immediately. In fact, if they just read the Communist Manifesto, they'll reject it immediately, right? But it doesn't take long to read the Communist Manifesto. And you see today a lot of young people saying, well, I'm not a communist. I'm a socialist, right? Or I'm a democratic socialist. I walk through that very carefully in the book. According to Marxist theory, history, the dialectic of history, would go from slavery, feudalism, to capitalism, to socialism, to communism. So socialism was the final transitionary step to communism. And Marx, Engels, and Lenin all spoke favorably of democracy. In fact, I was looking up yesterday, the statue of Lenin that was just erected in Germany, of all places, this dimwit, who they're quoting from Germany, saying, oh, Lenin was a champion of democracy. And people reading that probably with any knowledge of one are like, are you out of your mind? But I can tell you this, Lenin actually did write favorably of democracy. But the way that Lenin defined democracy isn't how we see it. He's not thinking like Madison and Jefferson and Washington. To him, and he even says, democracy means equality. All right. And his version of equality was economic equality, class equality. So I even quote Bernie Sanders on this. You have to ask these socialists, democratic socialists and Marxists, what do you mean by democracy? And you got to really push them, because if they truly genuinely understand it, the people who do indeed understand it, they're not going to want to give you an honest answer on it.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for your time today. And I would like to take you up on a part two of this show.
Let's do it. Let's get it scheduled. Maybe in a couple
great.
Weeks.
Thank you so much. And we're right on time. It's 11:14, so we have a minute to spare.
Okay. All right. I got a bolt. All right. Off to save the world.
Thank you very much, Paul. Bye.
All right. Bye. Thanks.
This has been an episode of TAN Conversations. To subscribe and support this podcast and other great free content from TAN, visit tanbooks.com and use coupon code CONVERSATIONS25 to get 25% off your next order from TAN's extensive catalog of spiritual works to strengthen your faith and interior life.